From Washington, the American Broadcasting Company brings you From the Capitol, a weekly interview program based on a major news story here in the nation's capital. This week, we're presenting Senator Wayne Morse, Democrat of Oregon, member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who is the most outspoken Democratic opponent of the administration's foreign policy in Vietnam. Senator Morse will be interviewed by ABC News commentators Bate and Langton, and here with the first question, ABC's George Watson.
Senator Morse, as a Democrat, you've been extremely critical of our involvement in Vietnam. The Republican nominee, Senator Goldwater, charges that our efforts there lack purpose, direction, and even honesty. Does that mean that you and Senator Goldwater agree that we're in a foreign policy mess in Southeast Asia?
Of course not. Goldwater wants war in Asia. I want peace. All the difference in the world. And I don't like to see a Democratic administration aiding Mr. Goldwater and his warmongering beliefs because we're making war in Asia, not keeping peace.
Senator, the government of Vietnam seems to be on the verge of collapse. What do you think the U.S. should or could do about the situation now?
We ought to stop trying to run a puppet government in South Vietnam. We've been running one since 1954. We're as guilty of running a puppet government in South Vietnam as Russia is of running a puppet government in East Germany. And we have no more right in South Vietnam on a unilateral military action basis than Russia has in East Germany.
What do you think will happen there politically if this government does collapse? And do you think it could go communist?
Well, there's always a possibility that it can go communist, but let me say that the people of South Vietnam ought to determine that, not the United States for them.
Well, we are there at the invitation and the sufferance, are we not, of the Saigon government.
Pure poppycock. Not only that, but that's almost subversive propaganda against the American people. We're there under an invitation of a puppet that we created back in 1954. That's not a legitimate invitation. We have run South Vietnam since 1954. That government doesn't do anything except under United States control and direction.
Well,
and what we ought to do is stop trying to create a new type of colonialism in Asia. We always say the United States has no colonial interest. Well, stop fooling yourself. We're operating a colony in South Vietnam. It's an economic colony. It is a political colony. It's not a geographic colony in that we don't claim or want to claim any interest in its geography. But the fact is, we have walked out on our historic opposition to colonialism, and we're in there helping Great Britain pull her chestnuts out of the fire as far as her colonialism is concerned, because you can't separate South Vietnam from Malaysia either.
It's been said, Senator, though, that the country could go communist, and that means that Southeast Asia could as a whole go
communist.
More
nonsense. That's the Dulles domino theory. It wasn't sound when Dulles tried to rationalize the United States into participation in South Vietnam in 1954, and when he imposed upon us the tiger, paper tiger known as the CETO Treaty. Burma communist, Thailand communist, Cambodia communist. Why, Cambodia is so non-communist, it kicked the United States out and said it wanted nothing to do with the communists and it wanted nothing to do with the United States. And so that little prince threw us out. The domino theory never was sound. And also, let me point out, South Vietnam's not at all essential to the security of the United States. You know what maintains not only our security, but the security of the free nations of Asia, the Seventh Fleet, the United States Air Armada, our nuclear power, and a good many thousands of American boys distributed around the Pacific. Now, we ought to just face the ugly fact that we're an outlaw nation in Southeast Asia. We're making war outside the United Nations Charter, outside the spirit and intent of the CETO Treaty, and in direct violation of the Geneva Accords of 1954. And the American people don't like to have someone point out that we're not always right. We just happen to be dead wrong in Southeast Asia.
Senator, well, we've been wrong then throughout the administrations of President Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson.
Eisenhower is the man that got us into this mess.
Well,
we're trying to carry forward a bad policy of Dwight Eisenhower and John Foster Dulles.
Why hasn't your view then made more headway in the present administration, which is a Democratic administration?
Well, you never want to worry if you're in the minority about a minority view not making headway in your time, but wait till the historians get through. And the historians will underwrite my view. In fact, your leading American historians of today are already underwriting my point of view. We profess in hypocritical fashion that we believe in substituting the rule of law for the jungle law of military might. And yet the United States is practicing the jungle law of military might in Southeast Asia. So is Red China. So is North Vietnam. Does that give us any satisfaction? There's only one place for all these nations to go if they want to maintain peace, and that's to the United Nations. Why aren't we there?
Is that your solution, Senator, the United Nations?
Well, my solution is the United Nations, or first a 14-nation conference with the recommendations of that conference going to the United Nations, because that's the only solution mankind has. There's no other solution. If you think the solution is the exercise of unilateral military power, then all you're doing is advocating leading mankind to its own destruction. Now, we signed the Treaty of the United Nations. It specifically, in article after article, places a commitment on us to submit all disputes that threaten the peace of the world to the United Nations. The United States hasn't done it. You know why it hasn't done it? Because you'd find an overwhelming majority of the nations in the United Nations couldn't support our policy.
Do you think we could get into a position with the United Nations in there where there'd be the Russian veto and the problem of financing again?
Well, you don't have any problem outside of the Security Council problem. If they want to veto it in the Security Council, I want to put them on the spot. I want to show the world who it is that's seeking peace. I'd like to have the world have reason to believe the United States is seeking peace, but we're not. We're making war. I want to put Russia in the position where she either has to approve in the Security Council or veto. If she vetoes, then let me say she convicts herself of seeking to create a threat to the peace. But after the Security Council gets through, remember, the General Assembly can act then. That's what the General Assembly did, don't forget, in connection with the Congo. I'm asking that we follow the same rule of law approach that we follow in the Middle East, with the United Nations peacekeeping force there, that we did in the Congo for some time. We got out too soon. I hope this General Assembly will put us back in, and that we're now following in the Cyprus. If it's right for those three troubled spots, what's wrong with doing it in South Vietnam?
Senator, I believe that Secretary of State Rusk argues that the only problem in Southeast Asia is that the communist North Vietnamese don't leave their neighbors alone.
Well, of course, that's complete begging the question. That's complete begging the question. They, on the other hand, say the only trouble is that the only foreign soldiers are in South Vietnam are United States foreign soldiers. You see, the interesting thing about all this is they haven't been able to prove at any time, in any briefing, before the Foreign Relations Committee. General Taylor, when he was over here just a couple weeks ago, took cross-examination like this on this, and he flunked the examination again, as he's flunked every examination, in my opinion, we've given him before the Foreign Relations Committee. In fact, I was opposed to his nomination as ambassador. I voted against it, and when I heard him the other day, I knew again how right I was. Now, the fact is, the United States is in there with foreign troops, not North Vietnam. The South Vietnamese soldiers in the Viet Cong are trained. Many of them were trained in North Vietnam, but they were South Vietnamese. And, of course, the United States trains a lot of South Vietnam soldiers, too. So it's the old kettle calling the teapot black again. And the fact is, both sides are 100% wrong, the United States and North Vietnam. And we ought to get this before a judicial tribunal for a determination of these problems under the procedures of the United Nations, or a 14-nation conference under the Geneva Accord. If you want to see how hypocritical the United States is, we've been saying, but we're in there to enforce the Geneva Accords of 1954, but we didn't sign them. And we persuaded South Vietnam, Dulles persuaded South Vietnam not to sign them. By what right, as a non-signatory to the Geneva Accords, do we set ourselves up as the policemen of the world? The ugly fact is, and Americans shudder when they hear it, but it's undeniably true, the ugly fact is We're an outlaw nation in South Vietnam.
Senator, are you in agreement with General de Gaulle on his idea of neutralizing Vietnam?
I don't know what General de Gaulle means by neutralizing. He's never given us a blueprint. I am in agreement with General de Gaulle that the whole matter ought to go back to the 14-nation conference that met in 1954, and the United States this time ought to be an active participant, not an observer, and the United States ought to be willing to go in and negotiate an improvement of the Geneva Accords of 54.
Does anyone in the administration agree with your ideas on foreign policy, Senator?
I haven't heard any of them publicly, but let me tell you, a good many of them privately pat me on the back. In fact, if these Senate colleagues of mine had the courage to talk on the floor of the Senate as they talk in the cloakrooms of the United States Senate, a majority would be with me.
Senator, if we can...
I want to say, if I may, just a moment, I've had one man stand with me shoulder to shoulder through thick and thin on this. In fact, he's been my leader, and that's that courageous senator from Alaska, Ernest Greening. We've had a lot of people, you know, that have had some second thoughts since the passing of this predated declaration of war. They've been making some noises recently on the floor of the Senate that they think we ought to go to conference. But I have said, you remember, on the floor of the Senate, where were you, senators? Where were you, senators, the last 6 months? For the senator from Alaska and I have been urging these very things, but you voted for this predated declaration of war. That's the time you ought to stood up and be counted. And had they talked that way on the floor, we never would have gotten into this mess in Southeast Asia.
Senator, if we can believe Dr. Gallup and the other pollsters, President Johnson will be returned to the White House for a full term in November. Do you foresee the possibility of any foreign policy changes when the new administration takes office, assuming that it does in January?
I never give up hope. And I'm hopeful that after Johnson's reelected, I think by a tremendous majority, as you know, I just came back from this Western swing with him, and he did a masterful job on that Western swing. The crowds were terrific in Sacramento. We had at least 250,000. In Portland, we had 100,000 that lined the streets from the airport to the breakfast. I'm satisfied. I'm hopeful. And I'd like to be satisfied that when this election is over, there'll be really a reappraisal of American foreign policy, and we'll change this mistaken foreign policy in South Vietnam.
Of course, remote as it may appear to be from the polls today, the possibility that Senator Goldwater may be elected also arises. How do you view the foreign policy aspects of a Goldwater victory?
Well, let me tell you, Goldwater doesn't have a chance. I don't think he'll carry five states. The American people are not going to be fooled by his warmongering. And I want to say most sincerely that in my judgment, the election of Barry Goldwater, unthinkable as it is, if you really pause long enough to assume the hypothetical, you'd find yourselves in a nuclear war within a year. And out of that war will be no victory for the United States or any other country in the world.
Senator, a few years ago you crossed party lines, and now Senator Thurman has done the same thing. Can you manage to feel any sympathy for him at all?
Well, I'm delighted that he's crossed party lines. I've always been of the opinion that the people in the Congress of the United States ought to join the political party that most closely represents their political philosophy. I did this more than 10 years ago because I knew then, and time has proved how right I am, there's no hope for constitutional liberalism in this country except in the Democratic Party. Now, Thurman has been assisting the Republicans all these years. His voting record has been a reactionary Republican voting record. He ought to have made the shift long time ago. I congratulate him that he's finally made the decision that on principle he should have made a long time ago. I'm sure he's being received with an affectionate embrace by the Goldwater Republicans. I only hope that that will cause some of the few remaining liberals in the Republican Party to follow the same principle and come on over to the Democratic side. They ought to have been there for years.
But, Senator, wouldn't that realignment of parties create problems? Most political scientists argue that it's a good thing to have a broad consensus within each of the two major parties.
Well, of course, I pay very little attention to the theory of political scientists. If I ever did, I never would have sat in the Senate of the United States. They teach so many fallacies in their political science and seminars that have no bearing on political realities. The American people are entitled to an alignment of political parties that give them a clear choice as to whether or not they're voting for a party that places human values first, which is the basic philosophy of Jeffersonian democracy, or a political party that places materiality and selfish interests first, which has long since become the basic philosophy of the Republican Party.
Do you see this as the beginning of a major realignment in the United States?
No, I doubt if it will be the beginning. I only hope that it might be, but I think that when this election is over and Goldwater goes down to the terrible defeat that he's asking for, that then a more moderate wing of the Republican Party will come back into control again.
Senator,
that'll be good for the Republican Party.
Senator, you have a long history of being an expert on labor relations, dating back to the Second World War, at least. We're in the period of negotiating contract settlements in some of our most basic industries. It appears that the settlement being negotiated in the auto industry exceeds the wage price guidelines that the administration talks so much about. Do you foresee any danger of inflation from the auto settlement or the settlement later in the steel industry and some of the other major producing industries?
Very little, because I think the demand for goods is going to be such and the competition for goods going to be such that they'll be anti-inflationary in their effects. But here again, let me say, I do not believe in government interference and free collective bargaining. And one thing you got to admit, that the negotiations between Reuther and the automobile companies has been a good example of free collective bargaining. I said a couple of weeks ago that, of course, in my judgment, neither the automobile companies nor the union could justify a major strike if their collective bargaining broke down. I suggested then that they ought to agree to voluntary mediation and arbitration. But I'm a great supporter in letting free collective bargaining work its course, holding the leaders of both sides to a responsibility of their own citizen statesmanship. And that's why I gave the warning a couple weeks ago that I thought both sides ought to face up to the fact that they couldn't justify a strike. But they certainly are entitled to bargain out their differences as they have done, and I do not think that the government should ever step in and say, but you can't have that contract.
You in favor of more tax cuts, Senator?
Well, whenever we can afford them.
Do you think we can afford one next year?
I don't know yet. We won't know what the fiscal situation is until next year. I was a strong supporter, as you know, of this tax cut, and I think that the time has already proved how sound President Johnson was in advocating it.
Senator, Congress is still trying to adjourn. I think most everyone wants to get back to his district or state and get on with the campaign, but the Senate, at least, is tied up on an issue of legislative reapportionment. How do you feel about legislative reapportionment and the Supreme Court's one-man, one-vote decision?
Well, if it's necessary to stop it, that we eat Christmas dinner still in session, I'm for eating Christmas dinner right here, and I want to tell you why. See, this deals with an abstract principle of government, and it's very difficult to get the American people to see the relationship between abstract principles of government and their very freedom itself. This is a proposal on the part of those supporting the Dirksen proposal to dictate to the United States Supreme Court. This is a proposal to bring to an end our basic abstract principle of three coordinate and co-equal branches of government. I don't care how they clothe these so-called substitutes for the Dirksen Amendment, like the one last week, the Humphrey Javits McCarthy, or like the Anderson one this week. They are, in effect, a rebuke to the United States Supreme Court. It's entirely improper for the Congress. I shall vote against all these substitutes. I shall vote to lay on the table. I shall join in talking this Dirksen Amendment to death, if that's necessary, until we can get some committee hearings. And to the American people listening to this broadcast, let me point out to you, there hasn't been a minute of committee hearing on the Dirksen Amendment. Remember, in the second place, it's an irrelevant, non-germane rider to the foreign aid bill. It has no place on the foreign aid bill. But you, the people, are entitled to have the constitutional law experts come before the appropriate congressional committees and make a record in support of and in opposition to the Dirksen Amendment. And I'm not going to be a party to the Congress trying to set itself up as the supreme body of our system of government. And lastly, let me point out that ever since Marbury versus Madison, written by that great Virginian Chief Justice John Marshall in 1803, the rights of the American people to have their constitutional rights protected is rested in the Supreme Court. Congress wants to play it's a Supreme Court. I'm against it.
Senator, back to the defection issue for a moment. Do you see any more Southern defections coming up?
I don't know of any.
Switching back
to... Any reactionary Southerner, I would welcome to defect and get over there.
Senator, foreign aid, as you just observed, is tied in with this reapportionment rider. You're a noted opponent of foreign aid, or at least a noted critic of foreign aid. What's going to be the outcome of that fight in the Senate?
Well, I think when we get rid of the Dirksen Amendment, they'll pass the bill in its present form. I shall vote against it. It's still a bad bill. We succeeded in getting a few Morris amendments adopted, and then we got the Morris interest position that was authored by Senator Mundt of South Dakota that I have fought for several years, with an increase in interest rates on these foreign loans. We got that adopted. That's a great change. Still isn't going to be a good enough bill for me to vote for, and I shall vote against it.
President Johnson says it's essential to be enacted. He cut it down to the bare bones, he said.
He didn't. He left a lot of fat on it.
It's $3.33 billion, I believe.
Well, he asked for 3.5. We've got it cut down to now about 3.33. It ought to go down to at least $3 billion. I would have voted for it if it was $2.5 billion, if you could get some policy changes. It's a wasteful, inefficient program. And, of course, they don't need it. You know what they ought to do to get out of this Dirksen situation if they can't lay it on the table? Just postpone the whole thing until January, because they got nearer to $7 billion than they have to $6 billion in the foreign aid pipeline. They wouldn't have to appropriate another dime to keep their whole foreign aid crew busy for the next 18 months to 2 years. They don't need any more money as now.
Senator, this Congress has passed an awful lot of legislation, the tax cuts, civil rights, the poverty bill, and many, many other bills. What's the secret of this deluge of legislation?
Been the best Congress on domestic issues during my 20 years in the Senate, as far as passing of progressive legislation is concerned. Well, I think that there are many explanations, but I'd like to put one that you haven't heard. The people caught up with the Congress. And the people finally made perfectly clear to the Congress, go to work and do something for the people. And they did.
Any idea how long this one is going to go on, Senator?
Oh, I have hopes that we can get out by October 1st.
That's your prediction?
Well, I'd like to predict it today. I may have to eat those words, but we could if they really want to settle down and lay this Dirksen Amendment on the table. That's going to be the determinative. If they refuse to lay it on the table, they can't get cloture. And so we'll be here, as I said, the rest of the fall, if they want to take that route. They ought to lay it on the table, get on with the appropriation bills, pass the National Defense Education Amendments, which we hope to have ready for them in a few days, and go home.
Senator, the Senate was unable to muster a quorum all last week. Are the people coming back from campaigning or wherever they've been?
Well, they shouldn't have gone away in the first place. I don't know where they are, but here again, I think the people will catch up with them.
Senator, I want to thank you for being ABC's guest today on From the Capitol.
Always my pleasure to be on this fine educational program.
Our guest on From the Capitol was Senator Wayne Morris, Democrat of Oregon. He was interviewed by ABC News commentators Baden Langton and George Watson. We hope you'll join us again next week at the same time for another program, From the Capitol. From the Capitol is produced by Peggy Wheaton. A presentation of ABC News. Listen to Edward P. Morgan weekdays on the ABC Radio Network.